Well, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it. You know, it's so interesting. I mean, I keep going around and saying to folks, who's going to the rally tomorrow, by the way? Oh, a couple people. All right. Are you going to have you heard about this government does not suck rally that's going on? This is put on by GovLoop, you know, the Facebook for feds. And I was talking to earlier on this week on the show, I was talking to Steve Ressler about it, and he's going on a bunch of different radio shows. And it's amazing because some of these radio shows, unlike our station, they're very angry people. And he was saying, people would say, all right, government doesn't suck. Tell me why. Have to defend why government doesn't suck. It's such an interesting world we live in these days. And there's so many bad stories that go on. And I remember back when Hurricane Katrina happened. And, you know, everyone's saying, oh, look, government messed up. No one could do anything. And there were, as you sort of peeled the onion back, there were remarkable government stories, people doing incredible work, actually making things happen and saving people's lives. And out of a very difficult situation in the Gulf, we get to tell you a wonderful story today about wonderful things that happened in that situation, too, and amazing lessons learned. And I hope some things that will cause you to think a little bit better, and you can go out and tell people how government doesn't suck. So we're actually going to tell a story this afternoon. So panelists are all going to come up, and literally we're not going to do person. We're going to go almost chronologically through how this happened. We're even going to start before that day when the deep water oil spill. It doesn't matter. We didn't negotiate seating, sorry. Round table, square table, is this all fine? Let me introduce our distinguished panel. Who is a distinguished Chris Dorbeck? Yeah, everyone, this week, Deidre K. Murray won the big ELC award. Congratulations. And somebody who does so much for this community, and congratulations. It was well-deserved. Let me introduce our panelists, and I'll sort of introduce them as how we're going to start. Michelle, right here next to me, Michelle Jacoby, right? I got that right?
You got it.
Is with NOAA. It's the agency that we hate to say on the radio. Do you know why?
No, I don't.
The name, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, it's very hard to say.
We're very nice people, though.
No, I'm a weather geek, so I love NOAA. I just like saying NOAA and not having to say oceanic, atmospheric.
You know, if you're a weather geek, do you know CapitalWeather.com?
Oh, love Capital Weather.
Founded by a former EPAer.
Oh, really? Wow. Anyway, Michelle is an environmental scientist for NOAA in the Office of Response and Restoration. Next to her is Captain James Cash. He is, get this, he fits this all on a business card. He's with the Office of Chief for Command, Control, Communications, Computers, and Information Technology and Sensor Capability. And he is the Deputy Commandant for Operations for the Chief Information Officer. Let me see the business card.
It's long.
It's like this, it's one of those giant checks, isn't it?
As with anything in the military, we turn it into an acronym.
There you go. Yes. Perfect. C4IT. Right?
Yes.
There we go. There'll be quizzes later. You have to name all C4s. And next to him is Jeffrey Levy. He is he is the Director of Web Communications for the Environmental Protection Agency. And a pet peeve of mine, he's not one of my Facebook friends. I know, I'm very upset about it, but I'll get over it eventually. So how we're going to do this is, as I say, they're going to tell you a story, and we're literally going to start before the incident happened. Remind me of the date. I had it written down, and I forgot my note.
April 20th.
Earth Day. That's right.
Well, it actually sank on Earth Day. It blew up 2 days earlier.
So we're going to start back in April, even before April. And Michelle, what were you doing then? This is before, no one knows even deep water. In fact, probably most of us didn't even know that people are drilling that far down in the ocean.
Exactly. So in March of that year, I had actually spent several months working on a drill. They do it every couple of years in which federal agencies get together and they run through a scenario. What would happen should you have a spill of national significance? So I had spent 6 to 8 months developing an application that would be used and tested out during this drill. When it happened up in Maine, and then lo and behold, 3 weeks later, we get the phone call that Deepwater Horizon has happened, and can you overnight stand up that system you used up in Maine? And so it was a very interesting week.
And talk a little bit about the exercise, because I know the exercise had some, it was almost like you guys had crystal balls or something. You were peering in and you could actually see into the future. It's just before Halloween, so it's a little scary that you could do that. Congratulations. I mean, this is something that you do regularly, right?
Well, the Coast Guard leads these, if Captain Cash wants to talk about that.
Well, whenever a spill happens that's really outside of one of the I-5 or I-95 towards the water, the Coast Guard stands up as the incident commander and begins to establish an incident command system structure to make sure that everyone comes together and we work in unison, both the responsible party and the federal government entities who come to respond to the incident. So that starts to kick off, and we practice that on bringing together a good number of people, but usually that's in one incident command system command post. We call it an ICP. I may say that acronym a couple of times today. So the incident command post stands up. That's usually where it stops and where we finish, where we complete the drill in that one command structure.
And let me just go back to this drill that you were planning, because it had, as I say, eerie premonitions of this was actually, you thought, okay, we're really going to test the system. This is going to be for a big, if there was a really big spill off the coast of New England, if I remember correctly.
So the drill that we ran was we were based out of Portland, Maine, but we had different command posts within Maine and Massachusetts, and we had a command post in D.C. And we use this application, which is called IRMA, the Environmental Response Management Application, in which those guys in D.C. or the other command posts could see where they thought the spill trajectory would go, where they were going to deploy booms, what was the next step for planning. Because during an ICF structure, you always plan 4, 8, 12 hours out in advance. And this was a way to visualize it. And so we had set up this communication. It's all web-based network system, so you could keep people in the know should you have these multiple command posts, which has rarely been needed. So that was,
And let's come up to April 18th, and all of a sudden there's this incident. And how quickly, when do you all get calls?
So NOAA works in scientific support for the U.S. Coast Guard, and so our Emergency Response Division gets the call to ask for support, and we immediately start setting up a trajectory for where we perceive the oil to go.
So is this hours after the 18th? Is it days after?
Oh, it's within hours of the call.
And pretty quickly you guys know that this is going to be a fairly good size incident.
Yes.
Even though the initial numbers, we were all over the place about how much oil is coming out, you guys know, okay, this is on the higher side. We're in red alert time here.
Yes, it became the Commandant of the Coast Guard at the time, Admiral Allen, quickly realized that this was going to be important to establish the National Incident Command to be able to work with the multiple state incident command posts and to make sure that we can communicate our needs to the federal government, our needs to private industry, to academics, and also to be able to report up, not just to the administration, but up to the American people of what's happening in this massive spill.
And so describe to us what you're doing in those days, the first month of this, because you're helping establish that command. I know we had Admiral Allen on the radio show, and he said one of the big challenges were there are so many organizations and entities that it's beyond herding cats. This is a big communication process.
It is, and we've, as Michelle described, we've practiced for that quite a bit in our biennial exercises. But traditionally, we have sent that information up through people would collect information on their ICS forms, writing down what they're doing today. They would send it into their command post, who would then transcribe that into usually spreadsheets. Those spreadsheets are then sent up to the National Incident Command in the spill, and we were able to produce a report that we can say what's happening in this event.
And you got to tell the story, because I hate to pull the gloss off of it, but we've talked before.
Yes.
And you were telling me the story. They do all this in paper, and actually there's great pride in doing this in paper.
There is great pride, because in an incident of national significance, take a hurricane, we stand up an ICS structure for that. You may not have power. So the reliance on a computer system locally is something that we've tried not to have be dependent upon. However, in this incident, we quickly discovered, as you started to ramp up to 20,000 people, 1,000 boats on the water, 100 aircraft in the air, and all of the information about that, we were not going to be able to manage that with paper and spreadsheets.
And so one of the things that we were doing early on, although you do need to have that constant phone and communication and walking between, what we had used out of the spill of national significance was a web-based system. And because we were going across such a large geographic area, I just wanted to show you a couple of pictures for this one. If you had a unified command post or a data command down in like Houma, Mississippi, you had the field teams coming in and flying information for where the field response, where the booms were going. They had, we were trying to track where the field teams were. We were showing in the upper right here where all the ships were going. And then you could see, I mean, we're going across three states with that. That's the trajectory in the top left. So what we wanted to do was have this in each of the command posts, which there were several, as well as be as transparent as possible to the American people. And so one of the things that I was responsible for and why I was asked here was to set up GeoPlatform, which was a publicly based website for folks to see. And so we started showing the trajectory, where fish closures were, satellite interpretations of where the oil anomaly might be detected, and just made this generally available to anyone that wanted to go on. So this was May 19th when they first did the attempt at top kill, and then July 12th when they finally put in the capping stack. And so you can see we showed where shoreline cleanup was occurring, where there had been impacts to bioresources, and this was just a website for folks to see, but we also had more information feeding back into the command post. And these are the real-time weather data sets, so you could see to help with planning operations for skimming and cleanups and burn units to burn off the oil. You had to know, is the wind speed too high? Is the wave height too much? So these kind of data sets were the things that we were filling in, and we were just leveraging existing data and packaging it up in one ready place.
Captain, talk a little bit about how you guys use IRMA. Did this actually play a role in helping you guide all these cats?
So as we saw, all of this information was being collected on paper. Everybody started to bring their own system to the scene. And they thought, well, maybe this computer system that I have can help out. And when we went down to, I sent a team down to take a look at what was happening with geospatial information so we could really understand the full impact of this. We went and we took a look at the IRMA system that NOAA had brought in. The National Geospatial Agency had brought their Google Earth system to be able to show all of the satellite imagery and any imagery collected by aircraft. And then there were others that were out there as well. BP had their own system that they were using. And so what we quickly discovered was if we were going to work together and be able to visualize the complete effort down here, we had to select a single common operational picture. And as we looked at it, one of the things that grabbed our attention about NOAA's solution was the ability to have a strategic common operational picture that our commanders could use, internal, and then provide a subset of really important information that the American public needed to see on geoplatform.gov. And so that was the primary reason we selected IRMA to be able to help us tell the story.
Jeffrey, one of the really interesting parts of this, and I got to talk to Admiral Allen about it a little bit, but this was, people were tweeting where oil was coming in. This was, there was a lot of, and even among different agencies, everyone's working to get their information out there as quickly as they can. This is a very, so describe to us what you're doing here, the 18th of April and the days, weeks after.
Right.
What's going on? I mean, immediately you know, okay, we're going to have some kind of role.
Right, right. I mean, first of all, it was the 20th, so blew up on the 20th, sank on the 22nd. I mean, the reason that matters for us is what we were doing in the months before this was prepping for Earth Day. I mean, that was our whole web focus on my team was, here comes Earth Day, yay. And by the way, this is the 40th anniversary. anniversary birthday. This is a big friggin' deal, and we want to do a lot of stuff for it. So,
and you did.
And we did. The other irony to this that
it's
really
BP, by the way.
Yeah, that really hit me was Earth Day was founded to be about a year after the Santa Barbara oil spill. So the you know incredible irony that this thing sank on the 40th anniversary of a day that was to commemorate an oil spill. Really, you know,
Just write a song.
So, but the other thing that was going on in the months before this was, of course, open government, and you know, and you, both of you guys touched on this. This was, so I'll talk about that a little bit more in depth. I mean, we had all put out open government plans. One of our commitments is to making, in the long term, literally every single data point EPA owns will be made public. Now, there's some challenges in the systems behind that, but the commitment is there. And so, from day one, our website for this went live on Friday, which I believe was the 28th. Or maybe the 30th. And I mean, from that moment, we implemented two OpenGov principles. One was every single time we had a data point that had completed QAQC. I mean, it was not just, and this is, I'll talk about this with tweeting where oil was. We have processes in place that run our data through a very strict regimen to make sure that when we say something, we know we can stand by those data. That takes 8 to 10 days. From the time that someone dips a scoop into the water to the time we have data we can stand behind, it's not instantaneous. And one of the things you run into is the movies. I mean, people think that, I take this and I go like that and I read it right off the bottle. Oh, it's 20% petroleum. Well, it's right there. That doesn't happen. So one of our challenges is explain to people what the process is and why it's taking a little while. But that commitment was there from day one. Second thing was we started collecting ideas on how to solve this problem. And so from the minute our website went up, we had a form that anyone in the world could submit. And that process and the review of those things changed over time. And eventually we combined with you guys and we got a government-wide evaluation of those things going. But those are some of the things we were doing right as we were getting started. And we really had those open government principles in mind. One of the challenges we faced was we weren't quite on paper, but we were getting Excel spreadsheets. And we're like, okay, so we have an Excel spreadsheet. What do we do with that? Because another focus, and one of the differences in, we talk with Sunlight about this all the time, is there's open data, which means here's the raw data, go do whatever you want to do with it. But we can't stop there. I mean, as government, we have expertise on what those data mean, and there's a difference between data, knowledge, and wisdom, and the knowledge we have to at least provide what our interpretation of data are too. So we're doing that also. And we learned some lessons from Katrina about if we just say the number is 7 and we're always telling you what the number is and yay, and everyone's like, what does 7 mean? So we also were, right from the get-go, we had a communications team that was down in our emergency operations center that was writing up broader statements. So here's the data. You can have them. You can check it all you want. But also here's some broad statements that it turns out don't change very much from day to day. So we weren't trying to fight that battle to have something that was up to the last tenth of a second, but rather we're trying to give people a broader picture about what it these data mean. So those are some of the things we were doing right at the beginning.
Michelle, talk a little bit about this open data, because you guys were putting out a lot of information, creating websites. I mean, it really was a very different way of doing this than really has ever been done before.
Right. Because the incredible visibility of this, I mean, we stood up a site in a very short period of time, and the first day that it went live to the general public, we had 3.5 million hits that day, which killed our servers. We had to overnight them, redo, you're like, oh. Because previously, if you had 10,000 hits, that was great.
Actually, so, Dave McClure has this reflexive cloud computing.
Yeah, that's exactly.
I was reading it across the forums.
And we quickly moved to that exact system. We were like, because you think about going there, you think about, and when you have to overnight, things happen and you can move very quickly. So one of the very interesting things that happened was being able to share out to the American people the automated information system for where the ships were, because everyone wanted to know where the skimmers were, where the research vessels, and that feed had not been, we hadn't exposed that before, and that was one of the most popular layers for people to see. Here's the wellhead, here's the ship, and it's actually doing something, and that was working closely with Coast Guard on that.
Captain, talk a little bit about this open data aspect, because it also, and again, I talked to Admiral Allen about this, all of a sudden there's a lot of ambient noise around while you're trying to figure out, hold on, how do we get our jobs done? It makes things a little bit more complex in some ways.
Well, it certainly does. As soon as we had a piece of data about the ships, let's use the ship tracking as an example, that information is really about the larger ships. So the ships that are commercial skimmers, our federal ships that are out there, our research vessels, they all had this automated identification system. However, when we started to bring on the fishing vessels of opportunity, or the vessels of opportunity to help out in the skimming, they didn't have transponders. So we quickly had to figure out, how are we going to do this? The first idea was that we were going to put on these AIS machines onto those vessels. But we quickly looked and said, we're going to jump up from monitoring about 200 or so vessels. And if we all of a sudden start to add these AIS boxes onto 6,000 vessels of opportunity, will our system be able to hear them because they're in such close proximity? And with our research and development center, we quickly learned that was not the answer. We would actually have done a denial of service to the AIS system down there. So we had to shift gears and quickly started to look for commercial GPS satellite tracking systems that are used in logistics to actually screw in to the hulls of the boats and to some of the critical assets like the skimmers, the vacuum cleaners that were scooping up the oil. And then that became a challenge for Michelle to be able to reach out to those vendors and to be able to let them know that she needs to be able to ingest their data so we can display it in Irma.
And that was a lesson learned to figure out what are standard protocols that companies should have in place that it can be readily ingested, whether it be my system or the Coast Guard system or another system out there, so you can have these just best practices, ready access to the data sets. And the really funny thing I found was that in our culture now, everyone wants to know everything instantaneously. Right. You were talking about the QAing right. of data. So as soon as they found the ships, then they said, well, where are your field teams? And so we started to put them on each field team person, and you could see where the teams were going, and you could literally zoom in with these high-resolution imageries and see where folks were in the marsh, where they were next to the boom, and, if they were taking a long lunch break. You could see it all.
Talk about accountability. And when you say they wanted to see, are we talking about the public or are we talking about you all?
From my perspective,
yes.
It was both.
Yes.
Yeah, but the field teams wanted to know for planning the next day, were they going to get through all their field samples, or do they have to adjust the next day of planning? Do they need more staff coming in? So from an operation perspective, that was my primary feed.
And one of the real lessons learned out of this, and one of the real things that it seems like worked pretty well, was sharing that amongst a very wide group of folks, getting to a single data set. And how was that decision made that, okay, we're going to use Irma?
I think, Michelle, I'm not sure if you were down there, but it was one of my colleagues, Commander Rusty Dash was down, and some folks locally down at, I think it was in Houma. They all met together and said, we can't continue to have this, all of us having pictures that we're saying is the common operational picture, and they're different. We have to standardize on one. So,
and how soon in are we talking, when are we talking about this happening?
This is probably about day 30.
So early on.
Early on.
You didn't want to limit people from their system because they knew their system.
Right.
So you had to have these multiple systems and be working with them.
So as soon as we did that, this working group, about 4 or 5 people of our GIS experts from NGA, NOAA, Coast Guard, they all said we have to have one. Commander Rusty Dash brought that back to me and went in and told the National Incident Command Staff Admiral Allen that we needed to have one system and he needs to designate it. And he did designate Irma as that system. So that quickly started to gel everything, but we said, great, we have one system. Now how do we get all of the geospatial data into that system? Because everyone has begun to create a wealth of information geospatially in their own system. So we had to quickly devise an enterprise architecture for Deepwater Horizon information flow. So when I said everything's on paper, it is, but everyone does enter that into their own system. geospatially, in relational databases, image product libraries of all of the spacecraft imagery, the aircraft imagery. We had to devise a way to be able to bring that centrally into the government's hands, because a lot of it's in vendors with the responsible party systems out of Houston. So we actually ended up moving data from the incident command post into BP's system in Houston, taking the data from Houston to the Coast Guard data center out in Martinsburg, West Virginia. And from there, for geospatial data, we pushed it to Irma out in Seattle.
By the way, when he says responsible party, that means BP. Just occasionally I hear it, and I'm like, who's he talking about? That's BP. Jeffrey, talk a little bit about, I mean, again, a lot of challenges with getting this data out in a form that is really usable.
Yeah, that's the challenge. Well, and also, I need to be clear. So these folks are talking about operational data. Where are the assets in place to actually respond to the spill? The data we're getting back are environmental data. They're not driving response. They're just reporting on what is the situation. So one of the first things we had to do was try to establish a very wide network of sensors that would establish a baseline, even before the oil got anywhere, really. I mean, before it got anywhere close to shore. So we had these spreadsheets, and the immediate thing we started doing was just publishing the spreadsheets. We did publish latitudes and longitudes, because, again, one of the things is that supposedly everyone wants the data themselves to go play with them and create their own system. So we said, great. So from the minute we started, we included latitude and longitude. But what we were offering for download were either PDFs or Excel spreadsheets. And, again, through the open government community, I knew that that wasn't exactly ideal. So we pretty quickly started looking for other ways of getting these data out. And we actually found a company called Socrata. And this is where, if you're not familiar with social media in the federal government, what's going on is most of these third-party sites have these terms of service the federal government can't really agree to for a variety of legal reasons. And what GSA has done is gone through and negotiated special federal-friendly terms of service with now I think we're up to about maybe 50 or 60 of these sites. And we went out looking, like, okay, who's got data things? And this company, Socrata, did. So we quickly got that terms of service signed, and then we started talking about how we could use their system. So they take what happens is you upload a spreadsheet, and the world can use it without having to know how to use Excel. They get online tables that they can sort and filter in whatever way they want. And then the beauty of it is it gives you download options in Excel as an XML file, as an RSS feed, as a JSON feed, and then there's also some geodata stuff. So we got it into this third-party site that then spat it out in about seven different ways, anyway, anybody who wanted. So that was one way we got it out there, so at least we could make it more broadly available. We also started playing around with some maps, but meanwhile we had some internal programs that were creating maps too, and those turned out to be better, so we went with those. But some of these third-party sites really are very helpful, and Socrata was one of them. We also got data into a Google Earth application. So there are a lot of ways to make this stuff available, some of which are more usable than others in terms of usability, but at least they're out there. And I kept tweeting. I mean, you know, I'm on Twitter. I was pretty regularly putting out notes saying, anybody know anything else? What else can we do? You know, we're using Socrata. We're happy about that. What else? I also, interestingly, kept tweeting saying, so is anyone actually using the data? We would love to know, what are you doing with this? And at least in my own personal Twitter, never heard anybody respond to that. So I'm still curious.
And I would say that it was a great experience between NOAA and EPA and sharing of data and relying on, because when you have your hands full, it's great to have other folks that can help step up. And so we would take their data sets out of the Scribe database and whatnot and then map them out so people could see it.
Right.
They could get it in download capacity to their analysis, and they could also see what was going off of their beach and have that data set available. So it was a great sharing of data between Coast Guard, EPA, and Fish and Wildlife Service and other agencies.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of IRMA is that it lets you combine all those things. So whereas one of the things with our maps, we were mapping our data, but in IRMA you could get current weather and where are all the ships, and you could put all that up again. It's a massive mashup, mm-hmm. And I think that's really the way we want to go in the future.
Plus EPA helped pay for the development of IRMA, so we gotta throw that in there as well.
I want to invite them to participate, but before we do that, for the last question, I'm going to ask, what's your biggest lessons learned from this? Here, what's your biggest challenge? What's the biggest challenge you faced through this whole process?
I think it was meeting the craving of the American people's desire for information. Absolutely. I mean, getting it out fast enough because of this instant kind of desire to know.
The CSI effect. Similar?
Yeah, that's a good name. Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Absolutely. And what it told us, and we're talking about within DHS now, is how do we take and establish, and instead of building an enterprise architecture on the fly, establish that repository for regular data, for relational databases, geospatial data for the incident. How do we establish that as a federal capability and provide standards out to industry, those people who in the future will be a responsible party, so that they can push their data into that repository so we can share it quickly? I think that's the area we really have some research in.
But establish, I mean, there are agencies that barely have enterprise architectures now, and they've been working on it for years. Building one on the fly almost seems quite remarkable.
It was late evening, so we pulled together the BP CIO. I was down in the Unified Area Command in New Orleans and in Mobile to meet with all of their teams to actually draw it out quickly. Where's all the data? We've visited with every individual out there, having gone to the incident command post and see who's collecting data, watch all their data screens, scribbling it all down, and then just quickly wired it up, and within a couple of months, we're still building it because we're learning more and more.
And when you have the president requesting those updates, it's amazing how fast things can happen.
Certainly. just to give you an analogy, scientists started warning about problems with the ozone layer in the early 70s. In 1985, the ozone hole opened it up. In 1987, we had an international agreement to ban Freon. So same thing's going on. There's no crisis. Oh, well, let's review and make sure every single thing is perfect and make sure everything's done exactly right, and we get, you know, the $29 million procurement out there, and it's going to take 2 years to define the requirement. You know, then something goes off, and as you said, you just grab everybody and put them in the room, and you say, don't come out without a solution.
That's right.
So it's kind of a natural way of the world.
Questions? My new fat friend.
This may be a little inside because I'm the retired deputy CIO for the Coast Guard, so I have a question for Jim. I want to set you up. The Coast Guard obviously has its own common picture for operations and incident management and that kind of stuff like there. But a lot of that information is restricted access by law and for security reasons and national security. How did you handle the exchange of data from Irma through the Coast Guard COP and back?
It was more than just the Coast Guard. It was also our DOD partners who were out with us. We all work in a system called the Global Command and Control System, and that's what was on board our ships out at sea. So the commanders who were out running the task force needed to know, where's tomorrow's oil, what is the aircraft imagery that's coming down, how do we get that data out to them when Irma is our central source? Well, what we ended up doing is to know that Irma was going to be the repository, but where all those layers were, and with our command and control center, we actually went and grabbed that data and translated it into the format for GCCS, and were able to push it out over the standard network, so they were able to see it. The ships at sea, because they have a commercial satellite connection, were able to go to the Irma website and see some of that, but that was challenging because we have limited bandwidth. The real effort, once we got it into their command and control system they use every day, really helped them understand their tactical picture and were able to be much more effective.
And so the Irma platform is actually open source, and so it is standard. The feeds can go out to be ingested in other systems, and that's right. Kind of the intent, to be versatile, to take it into other systems.
Other questions?
Just something that occurred to me in the beginning. I'm kind of curious why you were doing a spill of a national significance out in Maine. Is there something there I should know about?
He has a house in Maine, and he's quite concerned all of a sudden.
Well, now you're safe. So, yeah, no, it was just the area that was chosen. It was in the Great Lakes before, and so they just move around the country.
there's water there.
And I'll say one of my very first investigations in the Coast Guard, I was on just brand new out of the Coast Guard Academy on my first ship out of Portland, Maine, and driving around in the fog, what I had to do was a search and rescue case of a fishing vessel that had rammed into the side of a liquid nitrified gas tanker. So while that would have been a different kind of problem, fortunately we were able to rescue all the people. The vessel was destroyed, but there is quite a bit of product that's moving up there, and those are areas where an oil spill may occur. It may not be just at a wellhead.
Other questions? Yep. Oh. Federal News Radio's Max Kakis. I know you.
Hi. I'm Chris's chauffeur on the way back to the radio station this afternoon. I'm kind of curious because as this was transpiring, obviously you're all talking about means of reaching the public through social media and through electronic means, going through some of these. The place, I'm fascinated, by the way, about the story about the spreadsheets, being able to send it up to one place and having it available in several other formats. That's quite remarkable. But I'm also curious because there's a public affairs aspect of all of this as well, because you have members from your public affairs staffs. Each of your departments has something like that to deal with people like me from the media. And when the 24/7 news cycle shows up on your door, we can be voracious and we can be very demanding, sometimes unreasonably so. I was wondering if you have any lessons learned that would be of interest to the people in the public affairs community in how they can be a better bridge to the media and also get the message out that because it seems very clear that for a little while you didn't know exactly what message you had to deliver because you were trying to figure out what was going on. What do you have to say to the public affairs people?
So I can start. Within the Unified Command in New Orleans, the Joint Information Command was there, and we had representatives from each of our agencies that would have their nightly discussions about what's the highlights coming out of the environmental unit, what's the mission statement for the day. So they would filter a lot of that and come up with that discussion for before they came back to ask us many, many, many questions. And we also made up frequently asked question sheets, and we were being able to prepare. It was great to have that Joint Information Command there to kind of filter the constant barrage of information requests and to be able to come up with frequently asked questions so we didn't have to keep doing the same interviews. And so that structure was very helpful from my end, I thought.
I would agree. I think the insatiable appetite to get information out immediately, as we go forward, being able to establish capabilities like IRMA to be able to support that information need is going to be critical for us. I think that really is the demand that we heard. You heard us talk about we were very surprised and really on our heels trying to quickly lean forward and catch up with meeting the expectations of the public, our commanders, and the administration. We really have to put systems in place that, as I've told folks about our lessons learned, that I need a system in place so that as soon as I put that first piece of data, it's available not just to our commander and our administration, but to the American people, and they can see what's happening right now. Whether it's an incident in a Deepwater Horizon size incident or a much smaller incident like the Costco Busan that ran into the San Francisco Bay Bridge out in California a few years ago. Much more contained, localized, but still people need to know the same information.
Now, just from a social media perspective, I would say that you need to get your channel set up now and be using them on a regular basis and build a community today so that when something happens, you already know who you're talking to. You've already established a level of trust with them. They know that you're going to shoot straight. You're going to be responsive. You're going to talk to them. Also, be prepared to have your head handed to you in social media. People on Facebook did not hold back in their anger at EPA about anything we were doing. Now, I will say that no matter what we had done, we would have had people yelling at us. So, I got I got made aware of that because we're used to this. We've been doing social media now for a few years, and nothing surprises us at this point. But I had, not especially with the BP spill, but in another venue, I had somebody who was doing an outreach project using some of our central EPA social media channels, and she got back some comments that for us were kind of just, you know, day-to-day comments, but she wasn't used to it, and she was really upset. I mean, she was like, wow, I mean, these people really hate what we're doing. And I just thought, you know, and she was always just used to working in her program, and she was enthusiastic, and she had lots of public support, but she hadn't been exposed to that level of vitriol. So I think that's part of it too, is get used to it. I mean, grow a thicker skin. Know that when you're dealing with the public, they're not going to hold back. They're making anonymous comments. They're going to say things that they would never say to your face. And just understand that's part of the operating environment. But don't let that stop you.
And it's interesting because I often hear people say, you know, okay, I'll jump into this water once it all settles down and there's, you know, there's one platform and we know what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And what I often say is, okay, are you going to wait like 70,
forever.
80, 90 years? And even then, I don't think we'll be at one platform. Or, you know, it's evolving so quickly, and you won't learn this stuff unless you actually, you've got to do it.
Give it a shot.
Yeah.
A word I love that I borrowed from the White House guy is face tweeting. So we face tweet. So meaning everything pretty much goes out as a broadcast announcement on Facebook and Twitter. And you get different responses on each of those. But that's just it's just become one of our, you know, a standard channel for us.
One of the interesting things that I see evolving, particularly around this open government thing, is this is really two audiences. It's the internal the intra and then the public. And they use this information in different ways. You were saying, you know, you made all this data available. You didn't see any public uses of it. But I bet there were government uses of it.
Well, I mean, just shipping it over to Noah Berman.
Right. And the difference between the general public who wants to know what's going on their beach, should they go out and sunbathe today, and the actual universities and the researchers and the private companies that actually want to use these data sets to advance their positions. And it's very hard to make the universal interface for those. And it's also very hard to customize to get those data sets. So you kind of walk that line, but it's better to start and then get feedback about how to improve it.
And I guess I would also say, speaking again, going to the idea, advice for public affairs people is focus on what they're really asking. They're not asking how much oil's on my beach today. They're asking, can I go swimming tomorrow? They're asking, can I eat the shrimp tomorrow? They're asking, will my job disappear forever? So they're going to demand for data. They're going to call up and say, where's the number for yesterday? But that's not most cases. That's not really what they're asking for. And keep that in mind as you're writing your fact sheets and your FAQs and all that kind of stuff. Give them the numbers, but also be preparing what those numbers really mean.
And that goes a little bit to what you were saying. There's a difference between data
and
knowledge.
Right.
Those are, and sometimes we don't make that differentiation. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. I think as we were hearing from different people out in the community, young people who are out in a condominium overlooking the beach, seeing a tarball and wondering why we weren't on that beach picking up that tarball immediately. The demand of what's going on out in the field really hit home. And so we were trying to actually building some more enterprise architectures on the fly. We actually built an architecture of how we could take and change every person that we had out there, every 47,000 persons on that incident, how we could have turned them into a sensor. And to do that, we need to build an app for that. And we had a lot of good plans, just not enough time to implement. And I think that's an area where we need to really turn into so that as the public is using these new tools and quickly tweeting their concerns, we're also able to turn those people who are responding to the incident into that sensor that can give us the fact, look down, take a picture. It geospatially registers where that picture was located, just a couple of pieces of data we have to put in, maybe do away with those paper forms that they're handing in on a daily basis, and we're able to get it back central to get it into systems like IRMA.
I think we're you and Dave McClure are going to talk later, right?
We absolutely are. Yes.
And I'm actually going to put Dave on the spot and say, you've listened to all. Yeah. I don't get to see you that often. So, but talk a little. You're hearing all this stuff, and you work in this stuff all the day, and you are building apps for things like that, and a place where all agencies can use them. You've heard all this. What's your lesson learned, taken away from all this?
Well, I think it's more the opportunities that are in front of us than anything. We are talking about creating a geospatial platform for government-wide use, which has been a target that we've been trying to focus on for almost two decades. And I think we actually are in a position now with some cloud computing solutions to actually move standard data sets into a common, secure cloud environment where all of these agencies can access it very reliably, very secure, and very quickly. So I think, it just points to the ways that I think we can move with a little bit more agility than what we've been able to do in the past. And it's exciting to see what is here.
And one of the things I'm hearing is, we always talk about agility and the agility of, imagine if you were trying to do this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and when you didn't have that agility, it would be a lot more difficult process.
Oh, without a doubt. Back in the old mainframe days, that would have been very difficult. But the simplification, all of a sudden, we're putting a very powerful computer on everybody's hip, really. They're walking around with these things, and we weren't able to take advantage this time. We need to learn that lesson and figure out how to use this so that we can better inform our commanders and the American people.
And the great thing from these sites is we were getting feedback from the NGOs, the beach cleanupers in the local states that had applications, and we were like, okay, well, if we just modified your slightly so we have apples and apples information, we can ingest that, and we just need to figure out what those four or five basic pieces of information, then we can then have a standard so everyone can play together. And they were coming up with applications,
and there were the oil reporter folks, I think, yeah. oilreporter.org that were out there.
Louisiana Buckets.
The Louisiana Buckets mm-hmm. were out there.
We had them.
Was that helpful or a distraction?
I think it was helpful for folks to know that those organizations were out there and that it was and people cared and were part of it. And I do think the information was used by the responders, but they are also, the responders are looking at primary priorities for their operations. I think that was secondary information. They had their primary QAQC folks that were doing that job, and that information just further supported it.
I think we could have, going back to this, I see tremendous promise that those folk, those organizations that come to help that aren't a part of the official response, if we were able to ingest their information, what are they seeing? What were they able to accomplish locally as adjunct members of the response? I think that would be tremendous, and that really is an area we could have easily pushed them an app, and they could have reported in their, a few pieces of information that would have really helped our commanders.
But also, I'd like to take this beyond the BP spill. This is a we had Katrina, we had this, and for us we had 9/11. Those are the three major crisis responses I've been involved in at EPA. That's three in almost 10 years. But every day there are pipes leaking, there are car crashes, there are potholes, there are a gazillion different things that government, wildfires that government gets involved in. And again, as you're saying, using that citizen assessor.
Choose a month in D.C. weather.
That's exactly right. Power outages. One of the most incredible things I saw that to me was significant progress was during the snowstorms last year. I could get on Dominion Power and I got a map down to the street that showed me, oh, they know about my outage. Good. Okay. And they're working on it, and here's their estimate. As government, there are already things going on like that. There are already some cities that let you snap a picture and email your, or just even an app that sends in the picture of the pothole, geotags it with a GPS on that phone, and now it goes into their system. Well, we're working on a similar kind of an app for reporting environmental violations and spills. There's all kinds of things like that where we can, we can take in the information from the citizen and use that for our government function. That goes way beyond something like, the BP response is the focus of this, but I'm just saying some of these lessons are applicable way beyond a massive response like this.
Absolutely. Amen. Yes. You did your part.
What you guys did was remarkable. I like that. I like the whole in crisis you come together and create a great system. One. because from what I read, it's like dozens and dozens of agencies were uploading information, and getting all of this in one platform was wonderful. And it looks like it's like either the prototype or the precursor to this federal geospatial. Is there talk of doing that? And plus, is it being used now today? So could we go on and find out, okay, how is the cleanup going? I mean, is it still in use now that the crisis has gone and moved from the front page?
What have you done for us lately?
Well, definitely. So the site that I showed you is off of geoplatform.gov, and it was just the Gulf Response application, and it's live, and it's updated. You know, every day I have folks in the field that are updating it, and my group is actually part of the Assessment and Restoration Division, so we'll be around for quite some time as they do the NRDA and then the restoration recovery, and we're committed to have that Gulf area covered on that end. And I do think that, as they were talking earlier, that type of, we can get these different agencies to put the data sets up. They have the metadata, they have it up. We can facilitate that going up, and I think it's just a matter of organizing it and figuring out the best way to access it more globally and being able to pull it in for specific needs like a wildfire or, you know, some other natural disaster, and just be able to pick and choose what's relevant to your situation. And that will take a little bit of time, but I think we have the technology and the capacity.
Follow along and restore the Gulf.gov. I mean, that's the new site. That is the government-wide multi-agency platform. Administrator Jackson's going to be heading up the Gulf Restoration Task Force. We're already starting to plan to put stuff out. We're about to put stuff on restore the Gulf.gov about that. So yeah, you'll start finding as data come in about the restoration effort and reporting on how it's going. All that will be available there, and it'll link to things like.
Yeah, so we'll take the feeds for all the restoration projects, come in, right. Who's doing it, where the area is, and what's the primary species of concern.
I know that we're discussing and looking at what did we learn in this incident from this perspective, how do we document those as requirements, and working in some of our DHS councils, looking at how do we establish these systems as a solution that we use for the little incident and the major incidents. It has to be used every day because our responders, it's difficult for them to learn new things on the fly. I say that here, we've talked a lot about collecting information on the surface, but all of our aircraft and spacecraft that we're flying, getting all of the data from those very fancy pictures to be able to draw geospatial boxes around the blob that looks like recoverable oil, and then to be able to transmit that to the ground, or if it was done on the ground, where do they send it? We were able to do that remarkably well in a short period of time. Even from those aircraft that are doing that at the secret level, that all of their systems are, especially DOD, that are designed to operate in that frame, they were able to pull that data down and get it to the unclassed world. That was tremendous because all of this imagery is on servers all over the place, a university server, government servers, private industry servers. But because we were able to put in place the commander's critical information requirements from space and air, we were able to quickly say, this is a quick story and I'll just diverge to this. When I went down to Houma, Louisiana, and walked in to see who was controlling all of the aircraft and the collection of imagery they were doing, it was this one Coast Guard commander who had bright red hair. But what I noticed that was most remarkable about him was his eyes were as red as his hair. He was really just, it was unbelievable the amount of work they were doing. They had a tight-knit group of aviators who were there, and their job, because this was a massive incident, we jumped up from something the Coast Guard usually does in a major search and rescue case, 4, 5, 6 aircraft flying at one time. When I went down, I was sure they were managing 20 aircraft, but when I walked in, he said, no, we have 100 aircraft. And what's happening is somebody says, I see oil, and planes converge so everyone can get a picture. Wow. And we really had some near mid-air incidents.
Yeah. Wow.
And that drove us to two things. One is to set up an organization. We used Tyndall Air Force Base to establish an air operations command to be able to deconflict traffic, to set up temporary flight regulations to make sure that aircraft didn't run into each other. But the second was these commander critical information requirements. What does the commander need? Build a collection plan and make assignments on which aircraft would actually collect for the commander. And finally, on every knee board for the pilots who went out, a knee board is like their instructions of what they're to do in that particular mission. We were able to put on at the very bottom how to get that data to IRMA.
Chris, can we ask a question? I'm kind of curious. You mentioned the CSI effect. Are you guys seeing that? Or are you being expected to turn things around in a tenth of a second? Are you finding that no one's willing to accept that you might actually need to think for 30 or 40 seconds before? is that something you're running into?
Yeah.
Are you seeing that in the press?
You turned on the radio lately?
No, I don't mean demanding of you. Are you seeing that the public is demanding of the agency?
I'm talking about our state. Yeah, I mean, everyone. And we're trying to meet the demands of our listeners and get them the information. Right? Yeah.
This new generation is all just
I was curious, did you have to develop a specific protocol for dissemination of information for correctness with all the feeds of information? I mean, certainly within the military, the information you're getting, you know, is correct, but you're dealing with a number of different agencies, and as you said, you were dealing with some information that's outside agencies. I mean, how did you disseminate the correctness to be able to let that information go out?
It's
always a challenge with data because people say, hold on, is the data fully correct? And right. And if you wait until it's fully correct, it never gets out there.
That's right.
So we went through the Joint Information Command. And so if you had an agency's data set that, say, there was the birds, that they would walk out with mobile units and identify all birds, the Fish and Wildlife and that group wouldn't release that until they had told their Joint Information Command that it had been QA/QC'd and it would go back out. And other data sets, the planned overflights, that we didn't need to release those because they were going to be scrapped the next day. And so we just went off the Joint Information Command, and you had agency representatives saying, yes, we can go forward, and everyone would know.
When we brought together everyone to do remote sensing from the air and space, one of the things we found out that was that we were competing with one another. In one incident, when I brought in the chief scientist for BP, and we had our NGA, the National Geospatial Agency lead, was in with us. The NGA guy was mad because he was trying to buy commercial satellite imagery, but BP beat him to the punch, so we didn't have access to it. And I said, wow, we're competing with each other, probably driving the price up for BP to buy that data. But the bottom line was we needed to be able to establish a plan and who was going to collect it, and once we collected it, make it usable to everybody, to the full incident. And by building that collection plan, what we were able to say was, this is the authoritative source of data. That person is the one who we're going to allow to place into IRMA, and that will be our official answer. So there was a lot of that work that was going on behind the scenes to make sure that as we looked at everybody collecting data, we determined who is collecting it correctly and had the most accurate data, and that was the one we designated for display in our system.
And I think an important point, and both of you touched on it, but if you don't know, there is the thing called a Joint Information Center, a JIC, that's set up for every response, minor or major. Everything goes out through that group, and that is literally in a representative or more than one from every single agency. They're constantly having communications meetings, strategy meetings, so that's the way that is handled under the incident command system. So anything that we're, in addition, in an event like this, you're going to get told, you know, here are the people in your agency who are the key people who have to funnel all information. They're coordinating with their agency. So there's a tremendous organization that's not being set up on the fly. It's well known. It's well established under certain specific aspects of the incident command system.
All right. I have a question. So I work in a CIO office at the Department of Energy, and the word innovation is used a lot these days, right? And it's, what does it mean to this agency or that person and so forth? It's very much a part of the dialogue today and how this evolving role of the CIO is happening. Having more of a voice in forward thinking versus reacting to a requirement, to your point, Jeff, like how are we supposed to respond? Usually it's in a crisis. I know we've talked a little bit about, and you've actually held up, I'm interested in, given that I work in an innovation strategy shop at DOE, and a lot of my time is spent on what's on the cutting edge, edge, what's a few years down the road, what if some kind of scenario occurs. How much of the technologies that you may have been planning for were able to be utilized as a result of, unfortunately, a crisis that you were like, wow, we're glad we did some planning? And then how many technologies, and whether it's a device or an app, as you've spoken to, do you think in 2 or 3 years, whether it's through a smartphone or some device, the iPad, who knows what they're going to be used for, do you think will be more utilized, or we will be carrying around more so, not just in an emergency response scenario, but maybe just for basic communications?
Well, I'll mention one. One of the challenges we had with being able to get vessels into recoverable oil, let me restate, it's a challenge to be able to get into recoverable oil from the surface of the water. I've been a ship captain, and I ran our ships that actually have skimming equipment, and I've responded to an oil spill. So once you're in the oil, you can collect and skim away. But as soon as you leave the oil, to turn around and say, where do I find it again, is near impossible because you're at eye level with the oil. So you have to get an aircraft into the air. One of the challenges we had was these aircraft who were up in the air, and they would look down and see these vessels and yell down, hey, vessel with the white top, move 100 yards into the oil. And you'd hear back on the voice radio, who, me? Who, me? That didn't work very well. So we spent a lot of time having the aircraft dive down to try to read the name off of the vessel and then come back up and call down and tell them by name. So what did we do with that? We actually worked the White House. duct tape does everything. You're right. But what we ended up doing was taking transponders that it's actually a two-way communication system. We asked Walmart came in, and they said, we think we can help you with this problem. And they had a truck tracker system. And on that truck tracker, it was really a two-way paging. But the neat thing is it had two things, cellular and satellite data. Okay, because these vessels would go offshore and get out of cellular coverage. So that was a big problem that we had to work to address. So we did a prototype of putting this truck tracker system on board the vessel. And then up in an airship that we had deployed, we used an iPad. And on that iPad, they were able to connect back to Qualcomm's data center to see their website. We didn't connect this into Irma. But they got back to their data center, and they could actually see the vessel below them. And when they saw them and looked at it, they go, oh, yeah, that's the vessel I mean. They'd click on it, and we built applications quickly to be able to send a two-way page. You move 100 yards into oil. I think that's the way we're going to go in tomorrow. But some challenges of this phone today, while it's a cellular phone, there are new phones that are right around the horizon. They're coming to market now that are dual band. They also have satellite. If we're able to get that and overcome the telephone line problem we have out at sea or in some remote areas like the southwest border, as an example, if we're going to do a security incident, we can still do the app for that. Turn this into the single device that allows me to not only track the people, I could have handed this to vessels of opportunity, track them, wouldn't have had to screw in all of those things into the hull. They could have reported it out their situation. And quite frankly, one of the other pieces is when we have to communicate, one of our other major challenges was actually putting radios in the hands of everybody. We can turn these, because they're IP-based, we can turn them into radios so they can interoperate with land mobile radio systems. And I really think that's the area 5 years down the road that this becomes the solution for our responder.
Question, given that this was not a terrorist attack and it was not a natural disaster, but a commercial, caused event, have you been able to put a cost on exactly what the incident, has tallied up to? And will you be sending, or have you sent the responsible party a bill?
I think that's an above their pay grade issue, but
The National Pollution Fund Center is designed to be able to provide that bill, and their job is to do a full accounting of all this. They've been involved from day one, being down on scene. We have standard protocols about what is the cost of the incident, and then in the end state, all of the negotiations that go around, and the legal actions, quite frankly, that go around making sure everyone pays their due. So that's in place. That's still running. I was just over at the National Pollution Innovation Fund Center yesterday, actually, and I know they're very busy and working hard on this. So I don't have a number for you. That's not my area, but that happens for every spill.
And EPA actually has sent bills to BP, and we put out press releases about it. So I can't cite numbers, but if you go check out, or if you join us on Facebook.com/EPA, you will see announcements like that.
You mentioned that there are a lot of lessons learned here. How are you sharing those? Because there were a lot of folks involved in this specific incident, but there's a lot of folks in Coast Guard, EPA, NOAA, who weren't involved with this and yet are going to face challenges similar to this. How do you get those out to folks within your organizations and within the rest of government?
Well, we have a formal lessons learned process going on. We've set up a Coast Guard captain, and his job is to bring in all of the different parties who are participating and document their lessons learned. But I know already Michelle and I have shared, we've documented lessons learned and started to share them within each other. So I think it's going to happen. A formal document about lessons learned will occur, and we're sending that out, but it's not the timely thing that we need.
Right.
And so you're seeing that happen on an informal basis, communicating between us. I know I've briefed the Office of Emergency Communication, thinking of this both in a safety or an environmental issue, but also looking at the potential national security events.
Great. Any other thoughts?
Same.
I always give out a prize for the best question, and I'm going to – the former Coast – oh, he left.
Oh.
He blew it.
So now there's just a runner-up.
Yeah. All right. And Pete's seen it. So here, you get to win our question. Our station is owned by we're the sister station of WTOP. You know, you get the sevens and you start going crazy. I have to know what the traffic is. I'm not driving anywhere, but I have to go to the eights. Give me a call and we'll give you a tour of the glass enclosed nerve center and you can see the whole thing. It's very cool. Yeah.
Now, if I have to become your Facebook friend to get that tour?
Yes. And I will also send you, so I do this thing called the Federal News Radio Book Club. It's like Oprah's book club, but I make a lot less. And I don't give away things to the entire audience. Sorry. My next book, which is 2 weeks from today, is this book called The New Social Learning. And it's how, you know, we do a lot of formal learning in classrooms, but the real learning goes on outside of the classroom. And all these tools that we've kind of been talking around are enabling that in really interesting ways. And so they've written about how that happens and how you can then take advantage. So I'll send you the copy of the book, and then you can listen 2 weeks from today, 3:00. We're going to talk about the book. So I promised that we would I tap your lesson, a lesson learned from this incident, something that that is changing the way you guys are doing your job. And who wants to go first? I'll start with Jeffrey.
Thanks. We have to find ways to get information in from the public and use it well and promptly. And we did our best, and I think actually in the circumstances we did pretty well. But there are, on any problem like this, or any problem, a much smaller problem than this, there are a billion good answers that are not happen to be in the heads of people who are in government. And we need to find good systems for doing that.
Captain?
We've traditionally delivered systems, be it radio systems, computer systems, kind of focused on a specific capability. And what we've turned, I tell our CBP partners, Customs and Border Protection, that because we're trying to build interoperable systems, we're actually turning our responders to walking radio stations. That has to stop. And so the lesson learned is really that there's a desperate need to be able to turn everybody who's part of a response, whether it's an environmental safety or national security incident, that we need to be able to turn them into part of the team. To do that, we're going to have to make sure they have a device that can accept applications, that can communicate across multiple bands, that can provide a picture and tell us where they are. To do that, we really have to move forward to enable these very powerful IP-based devices to meet our needs.
Everything's going mobile.
Michelle?
And I would just build off of Captain Cash's statement that collaboration is really key, and that, you know, we didn't need to be working on our own, just NOAA base. It was great to leverage off of Fish and Wildlife and EPA, and we passed off different pieces of the puzzle that we needed to do, and then we came back with a far better product. And I think, you know, instead of having silos of excellence, we need to figure out what's our common interest and have a workable goal with finite deliverables that you can actually build momentum and go forward on.
So I always get upset, and I don't want to, I'm preaching to the choir here, but when people are out there and they say that the government sucks, I'm like, hold on, how can you hear stories like this and the incredible work that people are doing and think that? It's very frustrating to me. So I hope you will join me in thanking them for their wonderful service. And my 10-second ad, this afternoon we're talking to the Smithsonian historian about ghosts in the Smithsonian. How's that for a little, as you're driving home, a little Halloween treat? So I'll see you on the radio.
All right. Yeah, I just want to doubly thank Michelle, Captain Jim, and Jeff, and of course Chris for today's conversation. Very provocative, very informative regarding the Gulf oil spill and crisis communications lessons learned. We're glad that we at the firm can provide a platform for facilitating this productive exchange of ideas and information. Thanks again for your thoughtful insights today and for your strong support of the firm. Special thanks and shout-outs to Peter Gallagher, Deirdre Murray, and the entire Affirm's program committee for a stellar effort pulling this together in light of a pretty busy week in the government regarding conferences and all the prep work, so really appreciated that effort. We talked about it briefly. Chris stole a little bit of thunder. I'd like to take the moment to thank or to remind you that please join me in a round of applause for our program's industry co-chair, Deirdre Murray, who last week was awarded IACS, the Industry Advisory Council's 10th annual Mendenhall Leadership Award for her significant contribution to the federal IT community.